Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. We'll begin today with our Week in Review. On Monday, a solemn ceremony as the city remembered the victims of the Boston Marathon bombing 1 year ago. Governor Deval Patrick spoke of the resilience of community.
We are not strangers. We are, in the end, one community.
We also heard from the victims, including Patrick Downs. He and his wife, Jessica Kensky Downs, both lost a part of their left legs.
We have been there for each other, and we will continue to be there to pick each other up and celebrate milestones for years to come.
The anniversary fell on Mayor Marty Walsh's 100th day in office, so he waited until his 101st day to offer an early assessment of his tenure in City Hall so far.
We're continuing to bring City Hall into the 21st century. We have voicemail now.
Voicemail. That plus the rail company picked to run the city's trains and what sounds like a shakedown, and a new Chief Justice proposed for the state's top court. We'll dive into those stories and more with our Week in Review panel. And with us, former federal judge, now Harvard Law Professor Nancy Gertner is back. Hi, Nancy. Good to have you.
Nice to be here.
And Boston Globe columnist Adrian Walker joins us from Morrissey Boulevard. Adrian, nice to have you back.
Great to be with you.
So let's start this week with this very difficult anniversary of the bombings. And let's listen to a little more tape. Here's former Mayor Tom Menino, who gave a really poignant speech on Tuesday and said that April 15th will forever remain in the city's memory.
Now, I know that some of you can't hear me very well. It's not just because of the fancy way I talk. Oh, wise guys, huh? It's because you lost some of your hearing that day. Or maybe it's a little bit of both. But lean in if you have to, because I want to hear, I want you to hear this solemn promise. When lights are dim, the cameras go away, know that our support and love for you will never waver. And whatever you have to do to recover and carry on, know that the people of Boston and I will be right there by your side.
Yeah, that's former Mayor Tom Menino talking, remembering the bombings 1 year ago. Nancy and Adrian, I'd like to ask you both about this anniversary. And just a general question first. I'll start with you, Nancy. What struck you about the way this city remembered this event this week?
Well, it really, first, it was extraordinarily moving, and it was inner-directed. It was directed to the community, to support for the community, in a way that these crimes sometimes are not. Sometimes the response to horrible things like this is other directed, anger at an individual or group, et cetera. This really was incredibly moving because it said something about the community and the resilience and warmth of this community. I'm a former New Yorker, transplanted Bostonian. I was proud to be living here.
Adrian, I'd like to come to you with the same question. Your quick thoughts, first of all.
I've been struck all week by sort of the lack of anger and bitterness that people have expressed about this event, given the way it happened. And also, of course, by the incredible resilience everybody has shown. And there's just been a real, I think, feeling of warmth and compassion this week for, you know, what for this great shared experience that we've all gone through, this shared tragedy. And like Nancy, it's been sort of a proud week to be part of Boston.
You know, you both touched on a theme that I was struck by as well, and I thought Governor Deval Patrick spoke about it pretty in a very articulate way about how the entire city was affected by this, but he spoke quite eloquently about the way the city responded. Let's listen to this.
I hope that as we thank the medical teams and the public officials, we remember community because it all adds up to an enduring example of the power of common cause and of working together and turning to each other when we could have easily turned on each other.
So, Nancy, you were talking about the ways the city could have reacted, didn't react, and I was struck by that's exactly what Patrick was talking about there. working together and turning to each other when we could have easily turned on each other.
Right, and it was not just the absence of recriminations, right? Mm-hmm. That's one response. Who's to blame here? Who did what that they shouldn't have done? There's absolutely none of that. But it was also, you know, this was a potential, this was arguably a hate crime. Mm-hmm. Boston was the victim. Arguably, you know, the United States was the victim. I mean, and that has, in other settings, turned to recriminations against groups. There's a wonderful piece in the Globe today about a Muslim family that was waiting for the next shoe to drop, and it didn't drop. Mm. And that's something to be proud of.
Yeah. Adrian Walker, you know, we heard Tom Menino at the beginning of the segment. He was among many who spoke. And many of us were struck by his speech. He has many qualities. He's never been mistaken for a great orator, but that had to be one of his strongest speeches. You covered the man for a long time. I'm wondering what you made of what he said.
That was one of his strongest speeches, and another of his strongest speeches, lest we forget, was at the cathedral 3 days after the attacks, after he had hauled himself out of the hospital to sort of resume his duties as mayor. It's always been clear that this was an event that moved him as deeply or more deeply than anything in his entire 20-year mayoralty, and I think you hear that every time you hear him talk about this. This affected him both professionally, but also in a really profound personal way.
Yeah. Does this sort of his response to this, does this define, I mean, I know he was a mayor for 20 years, but I mean, obviously this is a huge piece of who he was as mayor, right, Adrian?
Absolutely. I mean, yes, you're right, that he was mayor for such a long time. Yet, what will ever be more important than this? What will ever be more important in his mayoralty than the way the city responded that week and in the months that followed? I think absolutely it's one of the defining events of his administration.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Well, a tough anniversary, of course, but we spent some time earlier this week talking as well about some of the big unanswered questions about this whole, really the last year, about the law enforcement response, what the FBI knew about suspected bomber Tamerlan Tsarnaev and when it knew it, about the killing of Ibrahim Todashev in Florida by a Boston FBI agent. I want to ask you each sort of what strikes you as the most pressing question that remains unanswered or issue that perhaps remains unexamined because of all of the understandable emotion that we've been working our way through. But Nancy, I'll come to you first.
It's, of course, an ironic question after I've just talked about no recriminations. Now we're going to begin the recriminations. Well, I think, first of all, there's an interesting question here. So there was the national security piece. There was the intelligence on Tamerlan Tsarnaev and what the Russians did or didn't share and the role of the FBI and the CIA. And then on the other hand, there is a story of a crime, the triple murder in Waltham that was unsolved. Whereas it's not at all clear to me that had there been shared information with Russia, et cetera, that we would have stopped this, since one of the conclusions of all the reports was that there were no connections to foreign terrorists. He was sort of a wannabe. So it's not clear that lots of surveillance would have, in fact, brought anybody to this moment. On the other hand, what would have made a difference would have been if the Waltham murders had been solved. I mean, the irony is that we're turning to national security solutions and surveillance and not, you know, ordinary crime and the issues concerning ordinary crime. He would have been in the, you know, in the view of everyone had he been a defendant in that. And I'd want to know why that didn't happen, where did they go, why wasn't this solved, why weren't there even any suspects with respect to that? That's something to look at.
It's a really interesting set of questions. I think there are a lot of interesting set of questions that could should be asked around the local law enforcement response. But, Adrian, I'd love to get you to chime in. What's your sort of big unexamined issue or big question that you have as we move ahead with this story?
Well, I certainly agree with Judge Gertner about the triple homicide in Waltham. And, you know, the big unexamined question or unanswered question is whether he should have been on the streets at all or could have been in prison. But I've also been very curious about the Todashev shooting. I've written about it a couple of times. And I think we need to know a lot more about what happened in that room and how exactly he came to be killed during an interrogation. I don't think we've had anything approaching a satisfactory explanation of that yet.
I agree with you.
Yeah. And of course, this is Ibrahim Todashev. He was killed in Florida during a questioning by FBI agents, and Massachusetts state troopers were there as well. A lot we don't know about that, including the fact that the Florida state attorney who looked into that didn't even have access to the FBI agent, which I find sort of astounding.
It doesn't seem like much of an investigation to me, I'll just say that.
Well, let's move on. This week marked the first 100 days of Mayor Marty Walsh's tenure in City Hall. As we mentioned in the intro, the 100th day anniversary fell on the anniversary of the Boston Marathon bombing. So he waited for his 101st day to talk about his mayoralty so far. Adrian, how's he doing? What's your take on Mayor Marty Walsh, 101 days?
Well, of course, we should always be wary of politicians grading themselves. But in fact, I believe Mayor Walsh is doing fine. I think it's typical that a new administration is taking some time to get up and running and make some key staffing decisions and so forth. But he's had a lot of crises unexpectedly to deal with, and I think he's handled them very well.
Yeah.
The St. Patrick's Day parade, and of course, just winter in Boston and other things. So yeah. I think Mayor Walsh is doing fine.
Nancy Gertner, your view?
I agree. And the 100-day stuff is a little bit of a contrivance, right? I mean, it was one thing to talk about the first 100 days in the FDR administration when the country was going to hell in a handbasket. You know, at this point, he's facing a very different thing, and he's right to sort of take his time. I do love the notion that we're upgrading to voicemail, however. That's really, that's a little chilling.
Yes, the idea that this is a revolution right. in 2014 says something about the old administration.
That's right.
Adrian, your colleague, Megan Irons, wrote in the Boston Globe this week that Walsh's early hires have been mostly white men from Dorchester and South Boston. He talked with reporters on Wednesday about this specific issues, and he took the issue of diversity in city leadership very seriously. And here's what he said.
Since taking office, we have increased the number of department heads of color at City Hall. And our goal is not to sit back. We're going to continue to move forward, continue to make sure that city government reflects the city of Boston. People live here.
So, Adrian, how is he doing on this issue? I mean, he's appointed Bill Gross to be police superintendent. John Barros and Felix Arroyo are in his administration, among other people of color. Is he making good on this pledge to increase diversity in city government?
Let me say that I think I am absolutely convinced that he takes this seriously, and I do think he's doing fairly well on it. You know, the problem is obvious. When you are mayor of a new administration, there are a lot of people who helped you get there, and you sort of owe them something, or, you know, you want to find places for them. His administration in the early days, I mean, when we talk about the number of white males from Dorchester who have been hired, I mean, that's not an accident. Those are the people who helped him become mayor. And I'm not surprised to see them moving into City Hall.
Yeah.
But he's made a lot of promises about diversity, and he is certainly going to be held to them, and he's going to have to keep them.
I want to ask you both about this, and we were struck by this. There's a photograph on our website of Marty Walsh throwing out the first pitch at Fenway Park. This was the week before last, actually, when the Sox were playing Milwaukee. It's an interesting one because right behind him on the mound is former Mayor Tom Menino, leaning on his cane and watching. And the former mayor has been a notable presence at several events since Mayor Walsh took over. And that stands in contrast to, say, I don't know, past presidents who make a point of staying away from the limelight for their successors. Adrian, what do you think? I mean, is this tough in some way for Marty Walsh to have Tom Menino hovering so closely by?
I don't think so, but I have been quite intrigued by this, especially seeing Menino at the White House with the Red Sox and so on. There really isn't an obvious precedent for it. When Flynn left and Menino became mayor, of course, Flynn left the country. And then their relationship was so toxic that they've hardly ever been in the same room, you know,
right.
in the 20 years since. So this is very unusual. To Mayor Walsh's credit, I don't think he feels threatened by this at all. I think he's fine with it. But I do think it speaks to Mayor Menino is having a little bit of trouble letting go role.
Nancy.
I think it's also that Mayor Menino is more than just a next mayor. I think he's become a symbol. I think he's sort of become, I want to say larger than life, but that's not the way that's not the best way to describe it. And so to some degree, it's not like he's just the previous mayor. He has a different kind of symbolism, and maybe the marathon bombing helped to contribute to that. So I don't think it's a zero-sum game that Walsh's presence somehow takes away from Menino's or vice versa. I also think that there's a little sense of, you know, he's getting on and is not well, and so these events are to be treasured.
Hmm.
Yes, he's sort of the mayor emeritus.
That's right. Yeah, I was trying to think of the right term.
It's good. Much better.
I was coming up with, he's sort of the FDR of Boston. I mean, he'll just be with us forever. But it's a nice idea. So let's move on. Nancy, this is in your wheelhouse. I want to ask you your thoughts about the governor's choice this week to lead the Supreme Judicial Court. Ralph Gantz has been on the court since 2008. He said yesterday that three big challenges are underway in the state's legal system, including the need for more lawyers to help the indigent and those who don't speak English. He said the courts are expected to solve more and more of society's problems and that justice is expensive.
We need to make sure that our civil justice system is not only fair, but cost effective, that we're providing a quality of justice that people can afford and that the cost of lawyering is not going to be such that people cannot bring cases to our courts because they cannot afford the cost of litigation.
So there's Ralph Gantz, the governor's choice to lead the Supreme Judicial Court. Nancy, your thoughts on Judge Gantz?
He's a superb choice. First of all, the Supreme Judicial Court is literally a treasure. It's a very, very fine court. While I have had major disagreements with the United States Supreme Court, the Supreme Judicial Court has been extraordinary in carving its own path. And then what was extraordinary about his remarks is instead of talking about high-minded, complex doctrine, he was talking as essentially the administrator of the courts of Massachusetts about what we can do to make the courts more responsive. Judge Gantz has been a leader in the access to justice issues, which is trying to make the courts available to people, trying to make sure that there are interpreters and the cost issues. And then when he talked about solving problems, I mean, that's something that state courts are uniquely situated to do. Having a drug court where you're addressing not just the fact that the guy, you know, robbed the local five and dime, but the fact that the guy, in fact, needed major drug treatment, or a veteran whose issue was not just crime, but really the 5 million problems that he had when he left Iraq. So I think, I mean, that he's not only superb on the issue of doctrine and leadership and how innovative the court is, but he's really superb and will be superb as an administrator of this court. It was an amazingly terrific choice.
Okay, strong support there for Judge Ralph Gantz. Adrian Walker, do you want to agree with that or take on Judge Gertner on that one?
By all means, I will defer to Judge Gertner's knowledge and expertise on this. But I will say though that Judge Gantz's comments, the thing I was struck by, it speaks to the breadth of the role, right? That you're not only are you rendering decisions, but you're also sort of the administrator and conscience and spokesman for the state's courts.
Right.
And I think he'll be great at that part of the job.
So let's move on. Adrian, you had a column last week, actually, and the story sort of moved on this week about a meeting between a representative of Keolis, that's the rail company picked to run the region's commuter rail system, and a Dorchester advocacy group run by some of the city's prominent black leaders. Now, that group, headed by the Reverend Bruce Wall, gave Keolis an invoice for $105,000, apparently a bill for their help and advice on how to increase diversity in the company. But a Keolis official described the meeting as a shakedown. Bruce Wall said the next day that it was a shakeup for Keolis, not a shakedown. Let's listen.
I'm in a position where I have to defend myself against the accusations that Bruce Wall, the man of integrity, has tried to shake down, not shake down, but in essence, shake up this commuter rail system.
The day after that, Bruce Wall resigned from the group. Adrian, this is a really strange story. Yesterday, he sent an email to supporters defending the invoice for services and called for a community meeting next week to talk more about it. What's going on here? What's your take on this?
It's one of the more bizarre stories I've handled in 28 years as a reporter, I can tell you that. It's very strange. I mean, when you look at the invoice, it's not for services rendered to Keolis. I mean, $35,000 of it is for two meetings that, you know, nobody ever agreed to pay for. In fact, all of it is for things that nobody ever agreed to pay for. And as for Wall's resignation, it's not clear what he's resigning from because this group was never even incorporated in the first place. So it's all kind of a mess right now.
Yeah. And what do you expect? He said he sent an email to supporters defending the invoice and called for a community meeting next week to talk more about it. I mean, do you know what's going to happen at this community meeting?
Well, I just know that there's going to be a community meeting at his church on April 24th, and We'll see. I mean, I'm not feeling a whole lot of community support for what they've done in this situation. The community, by which he means the black community, is as baffled as everybody else about why they would think they were owed this money or, you know, what they were going to do in exchange for it.
Really strange. Well, thanks for bringing us up to date on that. So we've got time now for our hubbubs, those stories that fell below the fold, but perhaps caught the eye of our panelists this week. Nancy, let me come to you. What's your hubbub this week?
Well, I heard actually on NPR this morning about the ambassador from Iraq who is running in the marathon. And it occurred to me, isn't that interesting? I mean, for one thing, the symbolism of that he felt that he wanted to, that he felt safe to do so in Boston is remarkable. I then began to think about the reverse, which is, will a day ever come when we can run as Americans in Iraq in the next marathon there? And whether they'd ever want us to, which is an interesting question. But it really says something about what we were talking about before, the extent to which the community has been welcoming, the extent to which this is an international event that actually takes place in a small town. Friends who've run the marathon who talk about, you know, going through people's backyards and how welcoming individual towns are. What a wonderful mix of international, small town and symbolism.
And well run. You know, it's interesting. I was at dinner last night with friends who happened to be hosting a friend of theirs from Australia who is run. He's actually a member of parliament in Australia. He's running in the marathon. He runs marathons all over the world. And he said, interestingly, Boston, one of the best organized marathons that he ever runs in. So I just found that interesting. Just an at random comment from a participant in the Boston Marathon all the way from the other side of the world who was here to run. Adrian Walker, your hubbub.
I was sort of fascinated by the decision of the U.S. Marshals yesterday to shut down Touch 106.1. This is an unlicensed radio station, a pirate radio station, if you will, that's been operating in Roxbury, Dorchester, and Mattapan for 8 years. And it's true that it's never had a license, but it's been an important voice of the community. And Governor Patrick, of all people, leaped to its defense today, said that he had been aware that the shutdown was coming and attempted to discourage it, and seems to want to try to broker some kind of compromise that will allow them to stay on the air and presumably do so in a legal fashion. So I'm very interested to see how that's going to play out.
Interesting. All right, well, here's my hubbub. It comes from the great state of New Hampshire. After 223 years, the Granite State is about to make adultery legal, finally. So apparently there's a law in the books from 1791, and it calls for adulterers to be paraded on the gallows for an hour and then publicly whipped, not exceeding 39 stripes, before being sent to prison and fined £100. That law apparently still on the books. New Hampshire State House of Representatives voted to repeal the law in February. The state Senate is expected to follow soon, and adultery will then be legal in New Hampshire. And by the way, I'm reading here from the Washington Post, more than 20 states still have laws against adultery. So there you go. Well done, New Hampshire. Adrian Walker, columnist for the Boston Globe, thanks so much for joining us and have a great weekend.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks.
It's really good having you. And Nancy Gertner, former federal judge, professor of practice at Harvard Law School. Always a pleasure. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
Coming up, listeners, if you're looking for a more comfortable commute, the world's first smart transit system is coming to Boston. We'll tell you about it. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.